Hello, everyone, and welcome to Heavy Potter's Heavy Cast. Very high quality programming.
Yeah, now with 80% more video issues. Video? Why
Except
did I
we're
say.
Not even doing video.
Oh my god. So the thing is, like, these podcasts, we always record them at the end of my work day, right? So now, dear listener, you're even more appreciative of, like, how lucid and cohesive I am when we record this. I just spent, like,
lucid.
Yeah. I mean, in comparison, considering, all things considered, the fact that I
that
just
was gonna
spent,
be
like,
lucid collective Samsung. I was trying to remember the name of the fucking arts bar song, and I couldn't, so it's just, like,
yeah.
Embarrassing.
Yeah. So I spent, like, 9 hours writing requirements or whatever, so my brain is mush.
Fun.
Yeah, it's so fun to sell your time in order to be able to eat. I enjoy that.
I don't have anything.
Yeah.
I just don't have anything.
I mean, if I wasn't enjoying it, why would I be doing it, right? That's how freedom works.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, free market. Your employment is voluntary, so, like,
sure.
Why are you complaining?
Yeah, you're right. Totally right.
Libertarianism is a smart and well thought out ideology.
Yeah, it's cohesive. It's lucid, one might say.
Speaking of lucid dreaming,
oh my god, are we starting there?
Yeah, let's just dive in.
Oh my god,
Dream Theater announced a new album.
First of all, why?
Why not?
I mean, the answer is the same answer as the first question, right? Like, why do I sell my label? Because money.
Yeah, I guess Dream Theater are ultimately still existing within the capitalist hierarchy, and they need to make more music to survive.
Yeah. How do they...
I'm not sure if this is survival or ego.
Okay, so, like, no, I don't think it's survival, right? These guys are, like, filthy rich at this point. It's definitely not survival, but they want more money, right? You can never have enough money. But there's so many levels to discuss here. I want to start from, like, the least offensive and go towards the most offensive. So, like, the track list is so, like, if you put a GPT, not a GPT-3, like a GPT-2 or worse, like, you trained it on Dream Theater track titles.
Oh, God.
Transcending Time.
So wait. The we didn't say the name of the album. A View from the Top of the World.
Yeah, which
the
is
new Dream Theater album.
Yeah, which is just like Rush, like bottom tier Rush album. That's how it sounds like. Or like a late Yes album or something. Transcending Time. I'm not joking when I say that there's a track called Awaken the Master. Now, like, Mike Portnoy is in Transatlantic. He's supposed to have, like, the Neil Morse pseudo-religious kind of bullshit going on, not Dream Theater. And then just the track lengths, right? Like, A View from the Top of the World, or a last track over 20 minutes. Wow, we've never seen that from a Dream Theater album. Like,
yep.
Guys, come on. And then the band picture.
Because the only problem with the recent Dream Theater albums was that the tracks weren't long enough.
Yeah. You need to go longer, because longer equals better. And then we drill down one level of awfulness below, and then you look at the band picture. So, like, John Petrucci keeps looking weirder, more like a Rasputin lookalike, or like someone who would chop you up in a cabin.
He keeps getting swoller and swoller. His beard keeps getting larger and more unkempt, and his clothing gets tighter and tighter.
Yeah, and like,
it's like,
you do you, right?
It looks odd.
Yeah, I mean, you do you, whatever makes you feel comfortable in your own body, but it looks fucking bizarre. And then James LeBrie, does he, like, he has so much money, right? Does he not, like, have a stylist? Or is he completely surrounded by sycophants who won't tell him to shave the goatee? Like, dude, what the fuck? The sunglasses, the jacket, the copious amounts of bracelets and rings. He has like seven rings. He has like seven rings on his fingers. Dude, like, I'm a bad dresser, okay? I dress in, like, metal t-shirts or, like, Hawaiian buttoned-up t-shirts and shorts, okay? And even I'm, like, looking at this, whatever he's wearing, and I'm like, what the fuck were you thinking? And then John Myung is just a guy. John Myung is, like, just a guy at the office. You're not entirely sure what he does at the office.
Yeah, he's just there, and he's, like...
Yeah.
He just does his thing.
He's, like, in a sweatshirt and just regular denim jeans. And that's it. And then Jordan Rudess looks like an Elon Musk fanboy or, like, a Steve Jobs fanboy from, like, 15 years ago. He has, like, the Apple Watch, and he's wearing a torn, like, torn jeans, and he has the beard. Oh, my God. And, like, the steampunk-esque, like, sunglasses.
I feel like with Rudess, like, he looks ridiculous, but not in the same way as, like...
Yeah. No, for sure.
LaBrie.
He looks like he's put together, right? There's a rhythm. Like
he looks self-aware.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, there's, he knows he looks ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. There's like a method to his madness, right? There's some sort of logic dictating. And then, finally, Mike Mangini. Like, he's also dressed, like, normally.
Yeah.
But the dude looks weird. Like, his face is odd. He looks like an Alice Cooper knockoff. I'm so sorry. It's so cool. But, like, I don't know. Something about him is so, like... And then he's...
Like,
his
hand... I feel like these pictures are... like, you know when you Photoshop these people to, like, make them look better and smoother?
Yeah.
I feel like this is Photoshop to make them look worse and, like, less smooth.
Yeah. And then he has his hand on LaBrie, which is, like, what is the... You've been making, like... You don't have to keep... singling out Mike Mangini. You've had like 7 or 8, is it now, albums together? Like 5 or 6, whatever. Like
5, I think.
Yeah, like a substantial amount of time. He's no longer the new guy in the band. Like, there's no reason to... I don't know. Okay, and then...
Petrucci is like standing slightly away from everybody else because, of course...
Yeah, you should do the lines, right? Like, Odess is leaning towards Myung, so he's like in love with him.
Actually, the more I look at this, the more I feel like they actually weren't together and they were all photoshopped.
Like, Mike Mangini looks photoshopped into the picture. His legs look like they were photoshopped.
Rudess looks photoshopped too. Like, he...
Yeah, yeah, he does. He does. He looks flat. Okay. And this is not even the worst part about all of this. The absolute worst part is the cover art.
Oh my God.
The cover art. So... They took a photograph.
A stock photo.
A stock photo of, like, a very famous place. I don't remember exactly where it is.
It's in Norway. It's this, like, two cliffs with a rock squeezed in between them.
Yeah. It's, like, very famous, but, like, on an Instagram level, right? Like, people go on the rock and take their picture there. And it's, like, if you reverse Google search it, it's, like, millions and millions of these images of people standing on the rock and doing, like, Instagram poses or whatever. So they...
Yeah.
That's not bad Kiag enough.
Is the place.
Yeah. If they'd just taken just that photo, that would have been fine. But of course, they're Dream Theater, right? And they have all the money they're saving on James LaBrie's stylists or whatever. They pour into unnecessary photo editors who take this photo, completely destroy it with the clone or the heel tool in Photoshop. Like, I would do a better job watching YouTube tutorials, right? Also, why? Like, they add a waterfall, they add, like, green grass for absolutely no reason. And then they add these, like, bizarre objects. Like, and you can barely tell because it's so small. Like, the image is so bad. I can't get it across. Just Google it. It's so bad.
If you look at a large version of the image, the Photoshop job is so poor. Like, it's cut, like, especially the binoculars that... Okay, so first of all, why did they put a binocular viewing station on top of the rock in the middle?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, a view from the top of the world, right?
It wasn't, it wasn't clear enough, yeah.
But they didn't Photoshop it. Like, it's not Photoshopped in. It's pasted in.
Yeah.
Photoshopping it in implies that you did some work to make it blend in. But no, there's no, like, the lighting doesn't match. There's no ambient occlusion. Similarly with the giant boots on there. And, like, a very poorly pasted in image of a child on top of the boots.
So, and when you go, I just want to stop you here and say that when you go to the website, I don't know if you've done that. There's, like, a slideshow in the background. There's an extra tarantula on the boots that isn't on the album cover art. What? What? Is this like a previous version? Is this like
there's a... also a There's a photo of like a photo op of the band that Ryan posted in our group that also has the band and then a tarantula shopped in front of them.
Ah, I see. It's all coming together. So
the lore.
Okay, so a few more details. Like the bird flying below the rock is just like compulsive yep. Dream Theater imagery that they couldn't help but add in. It's added in, by the way. It's not in the original stock photo.
Yeah, yeah. If you look at and the thing is, in the original photos in the background, there's like nature. They've replaced that out and put in like a really low quality image of a city. But due to the way they did the Photoshop, it actually looks like less high up than if the nature photo was there.
Yeah.
Like, the perspective is all wrong.
And then, lastly, my absolute favorite detail about this is that if you look at the right corner of the photo, it's clear that there is a level higher than where we're standing.
Yes.
So it's not even a view from the top of the world, because the top is, like, above you. There's another summit. And Nick pointed that out. And once he commented that, I like laughed for 10 minutes straight. It's so fucking hilarious. So, like, to bring this all back together, why though? Like, why is this so bad? These guys have so much money. They're signed to, are they still an Inside Out or like an even bigger label now? I don't fucking know. Inside Out. They're on like the biggest, and Inside Out is owned by Sony, by the way, I think.
Yes.
So, like, they're on literally one of the biggest musical companies on the planet and one of the biggest progressive metal labels in existence. They're one of the most successful bands to have ever, like, picked up a fucking instrument. And yet, they can't, like, go on Twitter and say, we need a new album cover. We'll pay $5,000 to the person who does it. You'll get so many covers so much better than this one. And then, like, pay a stylist.
Even if they ask for exposure, they would still get better covers.
Yeah, for sure. Like, I'm not saying keep a stylist on retainer, but you know you're going to have a photo shoot. I bet there's, like, lots of crew there, right? Like, a photographer and a lighting guy and catering and all that shit. You couldn't, like, get one person to style you properly? Like,
dude, you don't even need to, like, literally just ask the caterer. They'll have a better take on it.
For sure. Or if they don't, they can call their kid or whatever, and they can do a better job. Oh my god.
Okay, here's the last. So on their website, when I scroll to the bottom, there's a Did You Know segment.
Yeah.
I have to feel like this is pulling in random information from random things. Did you know the working title for the Ministry of Lost Souls from Systematic Chaos was Schindler's Lisp?
Oh my god. What the fuck? Oh my god.
Okay.
Moving
on to other quality progressive metal, there's an In Between the Buried and Me song.
Yeah.
From Colors 2.
Colors.
Everybody's
favorite album.
Yes. Oh,
I'm already over this, dude. I'm over this.
Yep.
I mean, go ahead. The second track is called, before we fucking gripe, Revolution in Limbo.
Yeah, Eat the Rich, Bro.
Yeah, and it's 9 minutes long. Longer equals better, right? And then after the first track, you know, we were very vocal about our opinions, both on here and on Facebook and shit like that. But we weren't like, this is trash, there's no way this is good. We were like, we have some questions, right? And Fix the Error or whatever, it was fine. This track is a fucking mess. It's a mess. And what's even funnier is that they directly quote the Great Misdirect riffs on this track. Like, the fucking, you know, well, they go up the scale and then down the scale, which they do constantly on Great Misdirect. They do it here, like, and I bet you, I don't have, like, perfect pitch or whatever, but I bet you it's the same fucking scale that they just go up and down, and it's obviously a callback to the Great Misdirect, so why is it called Colors 2? Why? Ash Avildsen, tell me, why?
Because calling it the Great Misdirect 2 would not generate as much hype.
It sucks, dude. It sucks. I hate it. And like, okay, so foreshadowing, we're going to be talking about Unprocessed's new single. And I was just thinking about like how good they are at branding and release and stuff like that. So Between the Buried and Me are arguably a much bigger band than Unprocessed. Right? Much, much bigger.
Inarguably.
Inarguably, right. And these two tracks posted on the same day, July 23rd. Mm-hmm. And the Between the Buried and Me single has 49,000 views, and the Unprocessed one has 65,000 views.
Yeah, Unprocessed have, like, cracked the code on new social media.
So, we'll talk about that, but also, how do Between the Buried and Me and Sumerian Records... Sumerian Records has 2.15 million subscribers. Do you understand how low of an engagement rate 50,000 views is for one of the biggest progressive metal bands on the planet? So not only are you doing Colors 2 for the clicks, you also suck at it. Like, you're also not able to generate the kind of viral hype that you hoped the name would do. Like, oh my god. Again, even though I don't like the recent output, I consider Between the Buried and Me one of my favorite bands. I think Alaska, Full Colors, and To the Great Misdirect is one of the best runs in progressive metal's history. Like, those three albums are fucking great. They kick ass. But it's upsetting to me to see how far these guys are willing to squander, like, good faith or stuff like that. Maybe I'm just overreacting and everybody loves this. They are, from what I can tell on my social media. It just makes me sad. It's so, like... I don't know, man. I want to live on a different timeline where this didn't happen.
Well, you can't.
fuck you. Well, sucks to
but
be
But I
you.
Think... Yeah, sucks to be you, bro. Yeah. I mean, it's bizarre. I mean, Sumerian, you know, they used to have their finger on the pulse too, but now they're just kind of like obvious has-beens when it comes... Like, they basically didn't capitulate on, like, the next wave of social media and the next wave of the genre. They tried so hard, but didn't get so far.
Yeah.
And Between the Buried and Me specifically, like...
It's like...
I mean, they're also... Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it's like a miniature version of Roadrunner Records, right? Like, they had 5 to 10 years of really, really, really good bands, and then at some point they just said, now we can, like, coast, right? We can glide.
Yep.
But when Roadrunner did it, they were
no,
like,
please. At some point they said, we're going to be a transmedia corporation and we're going to make movies because Ash Avildsen is a...
Yeah, exactly. But that's what happened to Roadrunner. Like, they also dabbled in some other stuff, like books and... music videos and a bunch of other shit, but here's the thing, Roadrunner were like orders of magnitude bigger than Sumerian ever was when they did it, so now Roadrunner sucks, and no one cares about their new bands because they're not signing anyone that's interesting, but they're still making a shit ton of money, right? Because I'm not too big to fail in the sense that Goldman Sachs is too big to fail, right? But they have this momentum that's keeping them going, and Sumerian is
like... Roadrunner has Code Orange, Coheed, Gojira, Trivium, Korn, Slipknot, Stone Sour. That's it. They don't need anything else.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't need to sign new and exciting bands because they have all these powerhouses. And then Sumerian has Between the Buried and Me.
They have all these like pop metal bands that they keep pushing.
Yeah.
Like Bad Omens and Palais Royale.
And like music aside, right? Like other people might enjoy that style. That's not what we're talking about here. It's just like baffling. They had so much clout, so much credit, so much relevancy, and it's just all gone down the drain because they're doing things like calling albums Colors 2 or fucking Under a Buried Body something. The guys who like faked the vocalist's kidnapping. That was Sumerian.
Yes. And they allegedly did that. Yeah, we can. Fucking whatever. I don't care about that shit.
Yeah,
I think the thing with the difference between Roadrunner and Sumerian is that Roadrunner had... They weren't just based on one thing.
Yeah.
Like, they had a diverse portfolio, and even when you kind of whittle that portfolio down, they still appeal to, like, a variety of things, and they have, like, very successful bands in a few different areas. Sumerian was always based on, you know, Sumerian core. Like, literally, they had, you know, their own genre, their own thing. And that happened to be the popular thing at a particular point in time. And then when that thing kind of died out, they didn't know where else to go. And then that's basically it.
Yep. Okay, we already mentioned Unprocessed.
Yes, let's do it.
Yeah, so Unprocessed...
Yeah, Unprocessed are killing it on new media. Like, okay.
Killing it, yeah.
Manuel Gardner Fernandez, you know, he's big on TikTok, he's big on YouTube, he's big on Instagram. But he's not like, you know, those Instagram guitarists that people keep, you know, deriding, maybe, perhaps rightfully so, in that he keeps doing interesting things. Like, his style is interesting and fresh, and like, he, when he puts something out, it's actually something that I'm interested in hearing, because he does something with it, and also he, like, his actual music is also good too.
Yeah. So that's what I wanted to say. Like, he has all that shit, but then he also remembers that at the end of the day, the product that he's making and trying to sell is his music, right? Or their music, in the case of Unprocessed, right? The band are, like, equal partners in that endeavor. So, like, it's actually good. And that's the secret, right? You don't have to obsess over your product to the degree that you go fucking Winter Sun, right? And you're like, it has to be perfect and everything has to be in place, but it has to be good enough. Has to be very good so that all your social media stuff really takes off. And I think that's what people don't understand. Like, out of, let's say, 10 musicians that go viral, I'd say that 8 or 9 make actually good music, right? It's only 1 or 2 that go viral just because of marketing campaigns. Like, you might not like it, or the definition of good might be fun to listen to at a club, or fun to listen to when you're cleaning the house or whatever, and not necessarily prog nerd putting on vinyl for an hour and a half and analyzing every note, but it still has mass appeal because the product is good, right?
I have a little bit of a different take, in that your kind of core music audience slash kind of build-up and your social media like Instagram, TikTok, whatever build-up, it's a feedback loop. So if you have just one, then, you know, you want to essentially funnel your TikTok audience into your actual music, and you want to kind of, you know, grow your brand, but you also want to funnel your actual music audience into your TikTok audience so that you kind of keep them engaged. And if you have only one, the loop breaks and, like, you don't keep growing.
Yeah.
But when you have both, you can keep having this feedback loop.
That's exactly what I meant. I totally agree with you. It has to be both. That's my point, right? You can't just have one and expect to, like, go super famous. Unless, you know, it's a fluke and, you know, like a meme channel or something picks you up and you blow up or whatever.
But if you don't have the loop, it's going to stop there.
Yeah, exactly. Like, a really good example is Rebecca Black, right? Like, she had Friday and now she's gone because there was no loop and the audience moves on, right? Like, virality moves on. Anyway, back to Unprocessed. So Candyland is like if Dead Roses, right? That was Dead Rose. And Dead Rose. And the track before that started to hint towards the poppier real fast, right? With Polyphia. Started to hint towards the poppier direction. Candyland is like almost all the way there, right? It's sweet. It's lighthearted. And it's very infectious, like very earwormy, right? It's good. Yeah. It sounds really good.
I was worried after Dead Rose that they were going to kind of devolve into like murky Polyphia territory. But instead, they like went all in on that and made something actually interesting out of it.
Yeah, I would have actually preferred if they stopped at the Dead Rose like territory, because I really like that song. And I think that Candyland has less that is unique about it, right? That made me go like, huh, interesting. But for what it sets out to do, it does it extremely fucking well. Like, these guys understand how to structure these songs and how to build them, which brings me to the fact that, like, Unprocessed comes out of the djent, progressive, guitar tech, whatever scene, and they continue to be haunted by a malaise, which we've talked about several times on here with that community, which is the YouTube comments. And it's amazing to me how they can't seem to shake off these fucking... So I don't want to say neckbeard because I understood it has like ableist connotations, but like basement dwellers, basically. So like the first comment, to me, this guy's pretty much fixed pop. Pop does not need fixing. Pop is a diverse genre with some fantastic fucking musicians, and it does not need a dude called Nate with a 7-string guitar in his profile picture saying that these guys fixed it. And then like, it goes on, right? Like, I really love how they're experimenting with pop. It's pop, but with actually talented musicians. Shut the fuck up, dude. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? It's just the worst. The worst.
Yep.
It sucks. Okay, but it's not their fault, obviously. It's just, like, the fandom. Yeah. Whatever. And the track is good, so go check it out. And there's no album announced yet, which is also interesting. Like, they're doing the single thing, which is very TikTok, right? Yeah, we'll see where they go from here.
Yeah, I think they at this point they've proven me wrong, and they've proven that no matter what they do, they'll be doing something, you know, interesting.
They should drop should drop like a Meshuggah-esque track next, like super heavy.
just confuse the hell out of the people who came in for the poppy sound.
I'm talking like Chaos Feel, right? Like old school grimy Meshuggah.
No, they should just drop something on the level of just 20 minutes of juggling.
Yeah. Okay. More progressive.
Yes. Leprous. Speaking of progressive bands that, you know, perhaps are kind of on a path towards redemption.
Yeah. And actually, this is a good antidote to Between the Buried and Me, right?
Yes.
And also, I'm reviewing this for the heavy blog drop that's coming on Wednesday. By the way, cross promotion.
Mm-hmm. Cross promotion of the same brand.
Yeah, exactly. So I meant like cross channel promotion, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I'll tweet about this later. Anyway, and I reviewed it because I really liked the album. But also, I got to be honest and say that it was like self-vindicating, because people would say, oh, you just don't like it because it's not heavy, it's not cold, or it's not bilateral. And I kept telling them, no, I just don't like it, it's not good. And now Leprous have made an album that's not cold and is definitely not bilateral. And I talk about it on my review. It's in the style of The Congregation and Melina and whatever, Pitfalls, whatever the previous one was called. I've already forgotten about it. But it's actually interesting. It's actually good. So, like, first of all, and I don't know Einar's, and I said this in the review as well, like, his biography, what he's been going through the last few years. I don't know why he sounded the way that he did on the previous albums, like, so disaffected and disinterested. I mean, we call it tall poppy syndrome because of him, right? Like, he, one of the first cases where this happened. And now, just in order to understand what we were talking about, just listen to Running Low, the previous single, or this one, The Silent Revelation, and then listen to any track off of the previous two albums, and you'll hear what we're talking about. Like, his voice is so interesting here. He does, like, is the S, like, soft on melisma? Melisma?
I think.
Yeah, whatever. Melisma's that's like
either that or, like, the name of a sex act. I'm not sure.
So he, like, changes notes while he sings. He screams. He goes all out. It feels like he kills. And it's not just him. It's the entire band. Like, the riff on The Silent Revelation is one of the most interesting Leprous riffs I've heard. It's not super technical, but it's really groovy and awesome and interacts with the track in really interesting ways. And, yeah, I fucking love it. And Aphelion is great. It's a really good album, which is fantastic to see after a few disappointing releases.
Yep. I'm excited to, you know, hear them finally go into something. I mean, a lot of people really like the albums that I didn't like, but, you know, for me, I've always felt that this band could be doing more with that sound, and I'm happy to hear that, you know, they are, and I want to check this album out. And, you know, it's always a good feeling when a band that you used to really like, that you kind of wrote off, shows that they still have something in the tank.
Some juice.
Even, I think, you know, even people who liked the previous boring-ass albums would enjoy this. Like, it's not doing something where, like, it's completely abandoning that sound and, like, you know, throwing away those fans to kind of go pander to the older fans. No, it's just kind of, you know, persisting in this direction in a way that is, you know, making something out of it.
Yeah, I want to say one last thing. We've often been critical on here of the staccato riff, and I think this track is really interesting because the main riff is sort of hinting towards those Leprous riffs, but does something else with it, which is what we wanted, right? Like, this is the act that's hard to pull off, referencing your old stuff while making it sound new. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think they do it really well on The Silent Revelation. So that's just another point. Aphelion comes out on August 27th, and you should pre-order it because it fucking rules. That's it.
All right. Speaking of progressive stuff, here, let me have you this one. Let me let you have this one.
So, Devin Townsend.
Yes.
Our relationship, I think yours as well, with Devin Townsend is complicated, right? In different ways and different parts of his discographies speak to both of us. Like, you have Strapping Young Lad, which you prefer, and I have the, like, the ghost, Kai, like, mellow, weird Devin that I like. And the problem with that is that Devin never really stays put on anything, right? He's always jumping around, and that means that most of his discography, if you like just one segment of it, then most of his discography is not as good. And I still like like Ocean Planet or Addicted or whatever, but it's not as good as those albums. And Devin just announced a new, I don't even know if we can call it an album, like a project, double album, of course, The Puzzle. And then the second album is called Snuggles. That's what it's called. Snuggles is going to be like even less of an album, I think. It's going to be like snippets or ideas. It's all like, I'm so tired of this. Through the lens of lockdown, channeling the hardships of lockdown. Okay, we get it, guys. Like, lockdown was hard. Can we stop making music about it? Like, everybody's making music about it. It's getting kind of old. So, okay. Whatever, it's Devin, so I kind of like give him the benefit of the doubt. But then he like publishes this crazy screenshot of all the people who worked on the album. It's like 40 different vocalists or whatever, and I'm like, okay, he's going full operatic, indulgent, over the top Devin, and that's just not interesting for me anymore. I just don't care about it. I think he's at his best when he reins it in. And this was looking to not be the case. And then he released a trailer, and lo and behold, it sounds like chaos. Like, it's a mess. It's like full-on, silly, ultra-progressive Devin. You know, like snippets of tracks with 50,000 notes on them and a million different vocalists. And who has... Like, people are excited for this. Who has the energy for this anymore? Like...
I don't know.
I mean, like... This was old when Steve Vai did it, because he was just copycatting Frank Zappa, right? Like, this style has been done to death. We all know, like, also, I get that Devin is doing it from, like, this personal place, and he describes it as, like, a cathartic purge, right? Like, he takes all of the ideas and throws them on an album. But what do you have to prove at this point? Like, we all know you're good. We all know you can pull this off. Like, you can do this crazy ass production and make everything sound really good, and it will be super experimental. Like we know. So, it's been. When was Ghost released? Like, a decade ago? Something like that. Let me check.
Has it been that much?
I think so. 2011. Yeah.
Yeah, decade ago.
Decade. Right. So, it's been a decade since he's done, like, the intimate Devin. Maybe we could say Casualties of Cool, whatever. That's like only 7 years ago. Isn't it time to go back? Isn't it time to like stop with the majestic, over-the-top Devin? So he recently released an acoustic album, but no one gave a shit about that because he didn't promote it as much.
It kind of also makes sense that the larger-than-life albums get more attention.
But I think it's also with his like... whatever structure or like publicity, it's obviously a B album, you know what I mean? It's obviously like second flute, second fiddle, whatever the idiom is, right? Second fiddle, second violin, I don't know. Anyway, it's a shame because, okay, I get it, he's not gonna make Ghost every single album, I don't want that either, but the pendulum has been towards like the ridiculously heavy for so long, and I'm starting to worry that it will never swing back, and that makes me sad because I think those albums are really special and much more special than another crazy ass album. That's it, that's my rant about Devin.
Well, he's announced 3 albums, maybe one of
them. I mean, he always does that. He always does that.
He's like the Brandon Sanderson of progressive metal.
Is Brandon Canadian?
No.
No, whatever.
He's Mormon.
He is?
Yeah.
Like, practicing?
Unclear. I think he's kind of, like, he's not very religious, but yeah.
Yeah.
He's comes from a Mormon background.
Okay. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Devin Townsend released Ghost 2. That's what I'm saying.
Yes. Speaking of ghosts, this is a terrible...
Oh my God.
Okay. Not speaking of ghosts, because that completely makes the segue. Okay. So... Unfortunately, this week we got the news that Joey Jordison passed away.
Yeah. At age 46.
46, yeah. If you're any you know, level of involvement with metal, you've probably heard of Joey Jordison. If not, you've like most likely heard of Slipknot, and Joey Jordison was the drummer of Slipknot. You know, yeah. I mean, he's like one of the most influential drummers of all time.
He introduced the mainstream to blast beats, basically.
Yes. And, like, he, you know, he was all the obnoxious, you know, I first found out about metal through metalcore, kids' is best drummer ever.
Yeah. I mean, so I want to say something about that. I think I also made that mistake when I posted about him, and I saw a lot of other people doing it. Qualifying.
No, I was gonna recover it, but sure, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, but I think the people who push back against that saying that, oh, have you ever like John Longstreth? Just because, like, first of all, Joey Jordison had chops for days, right? If you ever watch him play, like, he can play like a fucking tech death drummer. And secondly, he played like a tech death drummer on like fucking new metal albums. And yeah. the in my opinion, not the only reason, but a very, very major part of the reason why the first two Slipknot albums are so well acclaimed is because of his drumming. Because if you take away the drumming, if you replace Joey Jordison with like your average four on the floor drummer, those albums do not hit.
Yeah, for sure. I totally agree with that. Especially that last part. Like, Iowa does not work without that massive drumming. Like, People Equal Shit doesn't work. All of these, like, anthemic songs don't work without his drumming.
Yes.
But the other thing I wanted to add to what you said is that people who not only distance themselves from him, but Slipknot in general, they, like, post about it and say, I don't really like Slipknot, but you cannot deny... I did it as well, right? Without noticing. Slipknot are a good band. Like, I don't like Slipknot. I don't listen to Slipknot. But, and I think I've said this on the blog, on the podcast before, the number of, like, shots that I've done to Psychosocial, or, like, the number of, like, good memories that I have with my friends with Wait and Bleed or People Equal Shit playing in the background is massive. And I really like those tracks. And Slipknot have a lot of other really, really good tracks. And they're a good band, and it's okay to like Slipknot. You don't have to qualify it. And yeah, Joey Jordison, like, go and talk to drummers, okay? Like, find the metal drummer that you know and ask him if Joey Jordison was a good drummer. 95% of them will say, what the fuck are you even talking about? Of course. And then the other 5% will say, yes. Like, there's no, he's not controversial. It's not like Lars Ulrich or whatever.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, there's a really cool video that now resurfaced of Joey playing with Metallica.
Metallica, yeah.
Yeah, at Download that. Festival in 2015, I think it was. And they do For Whom the Bell Tolls, Creeping Death, and Seek and Destroy. Really good track list, by the way, for like a special set. It fucking goes. Oh my God, it goes so hard. Kirk fucking... He messes up the iconic For Whom the Bell Toll leads. You know that? He messes it up completely. Like, he misses five different notes on there. It's ridiculous. But Joey sounds fucking great. Like, he sounds really, really good. No, he said it was a dream come true. Like, he grew up on Metallica and Lars Ulrich's drumming and stuff like that. So, Yeah, and he was 46. And like, he had so much more to give, and it fucking sucks. It sucks.
Current generation metal drummers would say the same about Joey. Like,
yeah,
ask
for
any,
sure.
You know, any of the bands that we talk about today, like especially like the younger ones, they'll be like, "The fuck, man, Joey. He was a god."
Yeah, for sure. He was really good. And you know, there's the whole bad water between him and Slipknot, right? With him leaving, and he said he was fired. He also had like a medical condition, very rare one, by the way. Had like a spinal medical condition, which he seemed to have recovered from a few, like more than a decade ago, right? In 2010. And I'm not sure.
Yeah, he was doing like a black metal band. I forget what it was called.
I'm not sure if his passing is related to that condition or not.
They didn't say anything about his passing. They were just like, you know, respect the family or whatever.
Yeah, that makes sense. Anyway, this sucks every time it happens. And like we said last time, I mean, he was 46, right? But I think our generation is about to, you know,
next
decade, we're going to experience a lot more of this. And I think we kind of suck at it right now. And we can do better in like remembering these people that at the end of the day gave us the music that we love. So we owe it to them to like do a good job of how we talk about them and their legacy. Slipknot did a really good job, right? They were like, we don't want to talk about the controversy. He was our brother. Like, without him, there was no Slipknot. They blacked out all their social media. They did like a lot, like how you should do it, right? That's it. Rest in power.
Yep. The second member of Slipknot to pass away.
Yeah, true.
Paul Gray too, yeah.
Yeah, Paul Gray. Okay.
Anyway, so moving on to
better stuff.
A bit more positive stuff. So there's the new Rivers of Nile song.
This is actually a mixed thing, by the way.
Yeah, I agree.
So not
but it's
clean.
Still positive.
So clean, I really like the track. Rivers of Nile announced a new album called The Work, and they dropped a single called Clean, and I actually really like it. It's like really aggressive. It feels like, I know they're not, but it feels like they're gunning for Gojira almost with the main riff. The main riff is like very Gojira, but done better than the last two albums, obviously, and arguably the last three albums. I like the track, but I got a promo. By the way, quote unquote, stream only. Let us remind you that that's not a thing. My computer is playing the audio.
Fucking promos get better at it, guys. Let me tell you my take on this song, and you can tell me whether my fears about the album are founded or not.
Okay, go ahead.
So my take on this song is that I feel that they're going too much in the direction of... The reason that Where Owls Know My Name worked so well was that, you know, they had all this like crazy heavy stuff, but they also had all this like progressive stuff. And I was fearing for this album that they would kind of just go down this hole of the progressive stuff where they are just have these like long ass passages and kind of the music is kind of ends up being a little bit mushy. Is that the case with...
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, the case is that I put it on while I was working and it just disappeared.
Yeah, that was my worry.
Yeah, it just disappeared. Like, there's these, like, long, quiet segments and this, like, you know, lighter kind of vibe. And again, I don't care. I listen to fucking vaporwave, okay? I don't care if it's heavy or not. It just has no character. Kind of like wishy-washy. Now, to be fair, I've listened to it twice. Like, maybe it will grow on me and they're doing more things, whatever. You know, give
I
it
mean,
like
all of their previous albums were like immediate, like, oh yeah, this fucks.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not the biggest fan of like Monarchy. But yeah, it's still like arresting. And here I found my attention drifting. I mean, I'll report back, I'll listen more and see how it goes, but my first few listens were very underwhelming. Very underwhelming.
I think the reaction to this album is going to be too positive.
Yeah.
Again, in the vein of like,
yep.
Where Else Know My Name. I mean, that was a, you know, really well-received album, but I feel like it still didn't get as much credit as it deserved to, even though it was like, you know, very popular, right? I think that album is still like weirdly underrated despite being super popular because I think it was just that good. And I think the we're going to still see a bit of an over correction on this one.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's going to be like Jono Ko all over again.
Yeah, and nobody's going to talk about this album in a year from now where yep. people are still, you know, talking about Where Else Know My Name. Okay, yep. We'll see. Okay. I'm sure it'll be good, just not...
It's fine. I'm not saying it's a bad album. It's just... eh.
Speaking of bands that are, like, not bad, but eh, I think Cradle of Filth is a redemption story as well. Like, they... They're the butt of jokes among metalheads in certain circles.
Yeah.
And kind of deservedly so in for some of the stuff, right? I think they were, like, they had this era... that was, like, super corny in, like, the mid-2000s and early 2010s. But their 2017 album, Cryptoriana, was actually, like, really good black metal, like, symphonic black metal, right? I thought it was, like, super good. I came around to it later on when, like, a few people kept bugging me about it. And I was like, come on, Cradle of Filth, like, who fucking cares? They're just a joke. But then I listened to it, and I was like, okay, this is actually good. Like, this is them kind of going back to their pre-2000 stuff that, you know, put them on the map before they kind of became, you know, mainstream metal, whatever. And the new single from the new album, Existence is Futile, is actually pretty good. Like, it's more along the lines of Cryptoriana. And, yeah, if you're into, like, symphonic black metal stuff, this is pretty decent.
Yeah, I mean, it's just opera. Like, at this point, you're just listening to opera. They even have, like, an opera single on this track and in this music video. My main problem, you know, cliche, I just don't like Danny Filth's vocals. And also, he's a goofy guy in general. But he kind of owns it on this track, right? The makeup, the style. And I think he's reined back. Maybe his voice can no longer go to those places, which is good. Like the Danny Filth screeches, right? There are a few of them here, but they're more reined back. And yeah, the track goes really hard, and they kind of own the ridiculousness on it, which is good.
Yeah.
That's what they should do. They can't hide it, so they might as well just flaunt it, right? It's fun.
I think for the like albums where the band was kind of eh, Danny Filth was just banking on the thing with his voice.
Yeah.
But now, like, he's reined it back and made, like, he's actually trying to be, like, a vocalist. And not just trying to be, like, the meme.
And that's totally why it works. Yeah, totally agree.
All right. So check it out if you're interested in that. You know, there's not a lot of high-quality symphonic black metal bands out there. There's a lot of bands out there, but I don't think a lot of them are, like, very good. And this is, I think, you know, on the better side of things.
For sure.
And finally, and maybe this would have been a better segue from Rivers of Nile, there's a new Shadow of Intent track called Intensified Genocide, which, I'm not vibing hard on the name, and the lyrics are political, but I can't tell, like, what the stance is. You know, they're like, the civil division has far surpassed humility. They have completely descended to murder, plotting the new reign the parliament ponders. Like, I can't tell what their angle is here, which I don't like. Like, it feels like it could apply to you whether you're, like, a far-right asshole, a centrist asshole, or, like, coming from a leftist perspective. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't like that. But also, musically, I feel like the better this band gets, the less interesting they get. like, they've become, like, really polished in their sound.
Yeah.
But as a result of that, they've become, like, really kind of...
contained.
Just kind of contained and, like... like, there are bands out there that kind of sound like this more or less. I mean, these guys still have, like, you know, the synth aspect going for them. And their riffs aren't bad, but it's just, like, I liked it more when they sounded like they were trying to
When the
do
vehicle
things.
was like tearing apart at the seams, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because, like, I mean, I don't like death metal when it's too polished. And this is just kind of too polished. And, like, you know, when they had more breakdowns and when they had riffs that were maybe, like, trying too hard to be, like, synthy and death metal-y at the same time, like, that was actually worked better for me because there was. It just stood out more to me. And now it's just kind of like, yeah, just modern death metal stuff. Just,
Yeah,
yeah,
I totally
cool.
agree. I totally agree.
All right.
Okay.
More power to them. Whatever. Cool people time.
Okay, now the weird shit begins. It's a
Yes.
there's like two experimental things on the list this week that I'm very, very excited to talk about. One of
Yeah.
them, maybe we'll start there. I've been hyped about it for a really long time, and so have you, which is The Green Knight.
Have you seen it?
No, I can't see it because it's playing in like two theaters in Israel, and also there's a plague.
Yeah, sure. I have seen it because it's playing in a lot of places here, and I am vaccinated, and like the Bay Area is actually doing pretty well in terms of it.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll get COVID anyway, but hey, at least the movie was good. Okay, so The Green Knight is the latest A24 movie that has been like in COVID non-release hell for a while now. It was supposed to come
Yeah.
out last year, but it finally came out this year. It is by David Lowery, who also did A Ghost Story. It stars Dev Patel, and Dev
The
Patel,
excellent Dev Patel.
he's so good. He's so good in anything that he does. I
Yeah,
love him. He's
he's
so
amazing.
awesome.
He's amazing.
Hotel Mumbai was a good movie with him, by the way. I don't know if you it's an
Yeah,
underrated
I've
movie.
seen
It's like
it.
about
Yeah,
a
it's
real
very good.
life event.
Yeah, it's very good.
Anyway, he was so good there. Sorry, David Lowery, and it's based on an Arthurian poem. What is it like? What is it a poem? It's a
We
poem, right?
don't
Sir Gawain.
want to go into it because they'll do like an hour and a half on it. But
Yeah, Sir
it's not
Gawain and the
exactly
Green Knight.
a poem, but it's like one of the original and most well-known
Tale.
tale, Arthurian tale.
Yes.
Also a very subversive one, by the way.
Yes. And the movie is quite subversive too, and it is a fairly straight adaptation of the tale. It takes some liberties, but like not in the kind of way you would think. So okay. How do I the it's over 2 hours, a bit over 2 hours. It is very I know I say this a lot about a lot of things, but this one is actively very Lynchian in
Yeah.
the kind of in his like Mulholland Drive era sense of like
Trippy.
the text is not the text, right?
Yeah.
I mean, visually it's so beautiful. Every shot is beautiful. And also, so many of the shots, first of all, there's a lot of long takes. Not like obnoxiously long film bro takes, but like takes that are like longer than they could have been if you took the easy way out, right? There's like
Yeah.
a several minute long take of Dev Patel riding a horse talking to someone going through a field. And like it's not easy to do animals in long takes, but there are so many long takes with animals in this movie. Anyway, but also you have these takes where it starts off real. Then transitions into the surreal. And the movie is so disorienting because of that in a good way. And like, it's just an experience. So, I mean, I don't think general audiences will take to this movie. They might find it either boring or nonsensical. But A, if you're familiar with the poem or whatever, the original text and what it's going for, you'll get so much out of it because it's almost kind of requires you to know. The original, to some extent, to kind of get so much value out of it, because then you can be like, ah, I see where this is going. It's so calculated in what it chooses to show and it doesn't show, and it's so calculated in how it applies its themes. The editing is so interesting. Their title cards and they're really well placed, but also like. It does several different. It does match cuts. It does fades, and it does them like in so interesting ways. And Dev Patel, like, gives a performance of a lifetime. Even though, like, for the most of the movie, he's alone and doesn't talk to anybody. He just kills it. And the movie is gorgeous. It's so engrossing. It is everything I expected it to be. You know, I had high expectations and I wasn't disappointed. It is so good. It is, even among the A24 canon, you know, it stands tall.
Yeah.
And it is,
I'm very excited to see it.
Yeah. I don't want to overhype you, but I was basically, you know, I was very hyped and I was very satisfied.
I'm already fully hyped.
Erect.
Yeah.
To borrow gent vocabulary. So I think, you know, I think two caveats, right? One of them is that the movie is very surrealistic and kind of non-conventional, both in terms of storytelling and visuals. And secondarily, it doesn't care to kind of explain yourself. I mean, even if you don't read the original poem, if you have an eye for kind of metaphor, but not in the sense of like obvious metaphor that most movies go for, but kind of if you think about theming a little bit, like, I think it's fine to understand it, but I think it's better if you go in with like at least a cursory understanding of what the original poem is about. Or, you know, you can see the movie, and afterwards, if you kind of want to understand a little bit more as to kind of what the fuck just happened, you can kind of go back to the original text to kind of see, yeah, here's a more kind of straightforward telling of what this movie was talking about.
Yeah, I'm super excited. Okay. High flip.
Actually, while we're on movies and while we're on kind of similar...
Yeah.
I also saw Pig, which is, while not an A24 movie, might as well be. It stars Nicolas Cage, but also Alex Wolff, the kid from Hereditary.
Yeah,
and Nicolas Cage is getting all the praise, but Alex Wolff is also amazing in this one. So this movie is not what you think it is. The trailer almost makes it look like a John Wick but A24, where Nicolas Cage is a man who lives in the woods with a truffle pig. And his pig gets taken, and he goes on a quest to get it back. And that kind of sounds John Wick-y, but it's not. It's almost like an anti-revenge movie and like a deconstruction of the genre. It is so good. It's like if Green Knight didn't come out this year, it would have easily been my favorite movie of the year. It is so good. Again, Nick Cage has very few lines, but does very much with, you know, both his like bodily acting and also with the lines that he does have. The Alex Wolff, similarly, he talks a lot more, but he's so good in it. He plays this like rich fail son who's trying to like make a name for himself, but he's like obviously not there, but he also knows he's not there. Alex Wolff's character is the guy who buys the truffles that Nick Cage harvests, and he sells it because he's trying to grow his like restaurant business.
Got it.
And his dad is a restaurant mogul in Portland, and he's trying to like make it on his own. And like the pig gets kidnapped, particularly because of like restaurant business politics, and they go on this quest to recover it, and they, you know, it takes them to places where, like, you know, Portland's restaurant industry. Some critics say it's like, oh, it's a critique of the facile hipster foodie industry in Portland. It's not. Like, I mean, it is, but it's not like, yeah, it's not trying to reinforce your beliefs that foodies are bad, bro. It's not about that. It's about coming to terms with grief and loss. And it's I don't want to say too much about the movie because it's a very subversive movie. And it is just so good, and I would definitely say, like, check this movie out as well.
Yeah, it's so on my list for sure.
All right, now it's your thing. Take it away.
So before High Fleet, while we're talking about weird movies, I watched Come to Daddy with Elijah Wood, and it's good. It's not as good as those movies sound. It's not amazing, but it's really nice, and it falls into the category of you don't know where this is going. So the premise is, a strange kid who's like a washout guy in LA, wants to be a music producer, but he's actually just a loser, goes to see his estranged father, and there's bad vibes, right? Like maybe his dad is a criminal, or even worse, like a murderer or whatever. And then the first 15 minutes, his dad, like, they have a fight about why his dad left him, and his dad comes at him with a cleaver and has a heart attack and dies. Okay? And then the movie goes off the rails. Like, he starts to hear voices in the house, maybe he's being haunted or something's happening, and it turns into this very surreal movie that's in, like, the revenge kind of vibe. It has, like, a lot of, like, gross scenes that are supposed to make you cringe and so on, a lot of violence. It has a very good ending. And, I mean, Elijah Wood, you know. He's always good. Does a great job here. And it's fun. It's not, like, a masterpiece, but it's pretty good. Okay, now let's talk about a masterpiece.
Sorry, I just reminded one thing, sorry. One thing that I really
We're hyping High Fleet so much.
Yes. One thing about Green Knight that I really enjoyed was... the supernatural creatures are so matter of fact. They, like, you know, in these types of movies, you expect them to, you always, like, they speak in cryptic things, and like, but like the he encounters this ghost, and the ghost asks something of him, and he's like, but what will I get if I do this? And the ghost's like, why would you ask that? Like, like, what it. Well, the ghost just wants something, and like, why is this a transaction? Like, what is, like, what is the ghost, does the ghost owe something to you? Like, is this supposed to give you this nugget of knowledge or whatever? And even when, like, there's a scene with the Green Knight, and he's like, so what next? And the guy's like, what do you want? Like, it's like, in context, it's so much better. But like, that's one thing that I really enjoy. That the movie, like, the movie is very subversive. Hot take. Anyway, continue.
High Fleet. So before we talk about High Fleet, there's a studio. No. This is actually about High Fleet. The studio that published it is a studio like you all know of, but none of you know of, called Micropose. And you know about Micropose because they released a few small games like Civilization 1 and Civilization 2. Sid Meier first worked for Micropose. They also released XCOM, UFO Defense, and Master of Magic, and Master of Orion, and Master of Orion 2, and Railroad Tycoon, and a bunch of other seminal works in the fields of strategy and simulation. But then, through a series of unfortunate events and... lawsuits, Micropose was kind of broken up. First it was sold to Hasbro, then it was sold to Activision, and in 2019 it was revived by David Leggetti, who is one of the makers of, like, one of the most famous, like, simulation Arma. Arma and all that stuff, like all the milsim stuff.
He used to work on Arma, but then he left and made an open source milsim engine,
Titan IM. And to be clear, like, these guys also worked on Magic the Gathering, like, back in the 90s, Star Trek. They were huge. And now they're back, and they've released a few games which weren't, like, super well received except for, like, you know, hardcore fans. And now they released High Fleet. So what the fuck is High Fleet? I don't know. I've played it for, like, 4 hours, and I don't know what I'm playing. No, I'm joking. Let me break it down for you. So, it's easier to explain the setting, even though the setting is very, very detailed and extremely well written. Should be said, extremely well written. It's post-apocalyptic, but instead of doing, like, the usual aesthetic, like, you know, the ruins of Europe or whatever, it actually draws influence from the area of the world in which the Asian tribal nations, Turkey, Russia, and the Eastern European states came to clash in the 19th century.
And this game is made by the dev of Hammer Fight. I fucking love Hammer Fight.
Yeah. So, in case you're not aware, that area saw a lot of combat in the days before World War One, and is in fact considered to be the first, the one of the battlegrounds of the first modern wars. Right. So think about Crimea, the Azov Sea, the Black Sea, Caspian, all those places, and further into Asia, like where today, you know, the stands are, like Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, stuff like that. So that's the vibe. So nomadic mm-hmm. tribes fighting, like, conquering empires, which one of them is obviously the Ottoman Empire, right? You know, it's corrupt at the end of its days, this military powerhouse and so on. You play as the son of the emperor, and while you're on a mission, the capital gets nuked, and now you're the emperor. So introduced to that, the fact that the setting is very desert-like, and you're maybe the messiah, and you get Dune. There's like lots of questions of, do you want to embrace like belief that will make your officers mad because they're like, you know, rationalists, but the people will flock to your help. There's a lot of role-playing and a lot of faction standing, right? Like reputation, which opens up missions and equipment and stuff like that. Now the gameplay, you play as this fleet, which is the ragtag remnants of your empire, homeworld, and you need to navigate this roguelike setting. Because if the big fleets catch you, they're going to fuck you up. Like, you can't survive a frontal engagement. So what you want to do is make your way across this map, which would be familiar to fans of 4X games, like Civilization or Endless Space or Master of Orion, where you have nodes that connect to each other and you move across them. Now it gets weird. There's like 50 different mini games in the game. Okay? So when you start combat, that's like the most simple mini game. It's like a side scroller, arcade ship fighter.
Like hammer fight.
Like hammer fight, exactly. You gotta manipulate your ships, and the thing is, the bigger they are, they get super unwieldy, like floating gun platforms. You have like a million different kinds of weapons.
Does it have melee weapons like hammer fight?
No, it doesn't have melee weapons. Or at least I haven't encountered them yet, but it doesn't seem to be the vibe. It's more like different kinds of missiles and cannons and machine guns. It's crazy. But then you're floating around in between cities, you get a radio communication. So then you pick up the phone. There's like a phone that blinks. You click on it, and then there's a dial where you set the band. You move that with the scroll wheel to find like the band of the message. And then
of course,
there's another dial for the direction. Like, you got the frequency, now you need the direction. And if you do those fast enough, you can decode the enemy's transmissions, and it tells you where the fleets are going to be. If you get too close to missile carriers, they fire missiles at you, and then you remember those air defense games where you were on the ground and you were shooting missiles coming in?
Yeah.
That's a mini game in this game. Like, you use your ships to fire at those missiles.
I love it.
Now my review. The atmosphere is the best since Homeworld. Like, the sound design, the graphics, the writing, the setting, meticulous, like flawless. It's amazing. All the characters are extremely well written. The sound design, were, you know, all these panels, it's dieselpunk, right? So all these panels mm-hmm. like shunt, you get all these like industrial sound design. Incredible. The weapons feel so satisfying to fire and use. The game is difficult. Like, I'm talking Sekiro difficult. It's punishing to the extreme. Like, you're constantly on the run. You have no fuel. You want to stop to repair. Oh, by the way, when you stop to repair your ships, you need to land them in like a Kerbal Space Program Simulator kind of thing. Like, with hard physics. Like, if you press the thrusters too much, it flips your ship because of the torque. It's ridiculous.
What's the progression? Is it roguelike-like, or is it like, so, you save and you can try again? Is it,
I don't know,
death hardcore?
I don't know. So, I'm trying to maintain my run, like mm-hmm. fighting to finale. I'm not one of those guys that just says, oh, it's roguelike, I'm going to give up, right? But it's hinted that you get bonus points when you start the next campaign based on how well you did in the previous one. But you start from scratch, like you start from the beginning. But you have more money, right? Which allows you to get more fuel, which allows you to go places you weren't able to go to first. Like, I'm fighting tooth and nail. I'm not kidding. Like, I reload like 30 times a session. Like, constantly reloading to try and get better results. And not results in the sense of like saves coming where I want a better draw. Like, I want to do better at a fight or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like very few tutorials. and the tutorials aren't good. There's like this whole ship design. You can design your ships from scratch, and when I say from scratch, I mean like literally blank page. You add pieces of the chassis and like build them, but there's no guide to how to do it. A bunch of stuff like you put this machine gun. It's like I need an ammo loader, which will load the bullets, and you put it on. It doesn't work, and you don't know why.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah, it's obtuse to the extreme. So if you're looking for like a breeze or just a fun game to play, this is probably not that. But if you're looking for like hardcore strategy challenge with like the most unique fucking writing you'll get until Homeworld 3 releases and is hopefully good, God, please let it be good. this is the game for you. It's crazy. It's insane. It's so ambitious. Like literally the guy from Hammerfight must have like vetoed so many people when they told him, no, we can't do that. It was like, fuck you, put this in the game, I don't give a shit.
It has like big single savant developer energy.
Yeah, major. But the atmosphere is like what pulls it off.
Yep.
Okay,
excited. I'm gonna play it.
Yeah, fuck the other stuff. We can talk about it next week.
Okay, cool.
Thank you for listening.
Bye. Wrap around and gather for